Blog Talk Radio.
This is the Beat Your Genes podcast, and my name is Nate G. I created this podcast to bridge together the science of evolutionary psychology and the clinical experience of Dr. Doug Lyle, all so that we can discover what life is all about. In each episode, Dr. Lyle analyzes and explains the psychology behind real-life situations from our listeners on topics like romance, friendship, work, family, health, and many more. We broadcast live every Wednesday at 8:30 p.m. Pacific Standard Time, which means you can call us during the show and ask Dr. Lyle a question. The U.S. number is 657-383-0751, or send in your question through the website www.beatyourgenes.org. All right, good evening, everybody. It's Nate G. here, along with Dr. Doug Lyle. Dr. Lyle, how are you doing today?
Good, good. How about yourself? All is well?
Yeah, all is well. All right, today we've got a pretty extensive topic about morality, a little bit about altruism, and if we can get to it, something about free will. So we're going to try to run through this as quick as possible. But the big question came up, a lot of my friends have been asking, the fans of the Beat Your Genes podcast Facebook group have asked a few times here and there. Mm-hmm. But people want to know the story, the evolutionary psychology scoop, the Doug download on altruism. Mm-hmm. And the question is as follows. Dr. Lyle, what makes certain people do more for others than they would for themselves? There's some people who are so willing to help friends and extended family members, but yet aren't as willing to go out of the way to help their own family. Some of these people are married and have children, and it always seems that they were more concerned with how other people are raising their children and how said children are being treated instead of focusing on what's going on at home. It's like they're really great at giving advice to others and just are more interested in having them live a better life, but can't utilize and apply that same life advice to themselves. Does this actually occur? Am I misperceiving it? And if so, why do people do this?
This is great. Okay, I just glanced at this question before we started, but I didn't read all the way through. This is a thing of beauty. Yes, you are witnessing a real phenomenon, and it's got a much wider application than just the situation that you're looking at. It's what we're seeing is that each individual has their own personal cost-benefit analysis that they're running on life's agendas, and so each individual is fundamentally in conflict with all other individuals. So parents are fundamentally in conflict with their children. So let's look and see why that would be. Let's suppose that a husband and wife have a couple of kids. So we would think that, wouldn't a good parent be one that would, be giving everything they could to their two kids? No, because the parent is actually designed by nature, the wiring of that parent is designed to optimize their survival reproductive success, which is to say that, a certain amount of time and attention goes to those two kids, and then we want to have some sex, so because we're going to want to continue to reproduce. So the kids would just say, hey, look, we just seen you guys never have sex again. So guess what? We don't want the door shut on the bedroom, and we don't want, we want to be able to crawl in bed with you, and that's how we want it, okay? So even though these individuals, the two children, share 50% of their DNA with each of those parents, the truth is that all parties in this are in disagreement as to what would be the optimal behavioral outcomes for the group. So literally all four parties are in disagreement, and the thing is that if they're in disagreement, why don't they fly apart? Well, people's relationships do fly apart when they believe they've got better alternatives with other people to have cooperative action and that they can get better deals. So the parents will split up if they think they can get a sexier, fancier, more accommodating, or more resourceful and less conflictual partner. That will take place. The children will leave home and never come back if they feel like that they have a lousy deal in their relationship with the parents. The two brothers, Cain and Abel, one of them will kill the other one if the cost benefit is such that they perceive that to be in their best interest. In other words, everything is being analyzed through cost benefit analysis, and everybody's in conflict. Now the question is just because we're in conflict doesn't mean we're fighting or arguing. It just means that there are inherent conflicts. Because from my perspective, my DNA is the most important thing on earth. Okay, and even if you're my very best friend, that makes your DNA the second most important DNA on earth, not the first. And there's going to be conflicts of interest with resource management allocation decisions that are going to get us into conflict. And essentially what we're going to find out is that we're going to need to cooperate. So we are going to be making essentially, we're going to have a rhythm and a process of cooperation and anticipated cooperation that over time we're going to try to reach an equilibrium where it's as stable as possible, where people feel like they're getting as good a deal as they can get, and yet the deal is secure so that the other person is still willing to stay. So that's what's going on. So now we're going to go into a family, or let's suppose we've got, I don't know, a boyfriend and a girlfriend, and this guy, it's not like he's made of money, but he goes into a bar and at the end of the night, he's got a habit of buying everybody a round of drinks, and it infuriates the girlfriend. Okay, and the reason is he doesn't have enough disposable income to get her a nice pair of shoes, but he's got enough disposable income to buy, to take care of a $700 bar bill. So what's going on there? What's going on is that they have a conflict of interest over what's in everybody's best interest. For her, she wants a nice pair of shoes because she wants to display her sexual attractiveness, maybe mostly directed at him, plus, of course, a couple of Plan B strategies that she's not telling him about. And she would like those resources, and she thinks it's reasonable given the fact that she's given him access to her sexuality. And meanwhile, he's thinking, I want to kind of advertise to the bar that I've got excess resources that I would spend on females to see what other females I could dredge up, okay? So we see that they have a conflict of interest. So in the same way that a person who is the great family man or woman, that you can see that they could essentially be grandstanding to the village about how wise and patient and what a great parent or partner or et cetera, they would be, and how concerned they are with other people and how altruistic they are with their time and energy, basically grandstanding what a great mate or friend or trading partner that they are. And they are willing to take resources that could be used in the relationships, in their close relationships, and extend those out to other relationships in order to increase their personal esteem holding. That's what they're doing, okay? So we've all seen situations like this, and they all have a certain degree of discomfort but understanding. Let's suppose that you've got a family and you invite another family over for dinner, and it turns out that, mom actually cut it a little thin on making the roast beef, okay? I'm a vegetarian, but it doesn't matter. My parents weren't. Okay, so mom cut it a little thin. So when I go into the kitchen, my big sister tells me, hey, don't take any more roast beef because we got to make sure there's enough for the guests. Okay, so there's a conflict of interest. Like I'm thinking, well, what do I care about those guests? They're no friends of mine. Like I don't even like those people. They're not being nice, particularly nice to me. Their son is a brat. Like, what do I care? I want another piece of roast beef, okay? But I'm reading the signals and I'm feeling the social pressure that dad and mom are trying to maintain their status with these other people, okay? And mom might be very direct and give me a look, okay? So, incidentally, this never happened in my family.
Maybe carrot cake.
My dad didn't have any friends. My dad was a lot like Alan Goldhammer. It's like, yeah, you know what? what do I need a friend for? I've got one or two. So anyway, the bottom line is that this is the situation that the person's observing. So each individual is running their own cost-benefit analysis on their own personal best interest. That best interest most definitely has conflicts within their own family and within their closest romantic relationships and their closest friendships. Okay, how it is that those conflicts are adjudicated depends on a variety of factors. It depends upon the nature of the cost-benefit analysis that they run, which means not only their own confidence in replacing those existing relationships, but also their personality, et cetera, et cetera. So you can imagine, and this is why people are sensitive in relationships to signals like this. So this is why, in fact, one of my favorite romantic puzzles that people have heard me talk about is the love triangle in Casablanca, which, if nobody's ever seen it, this movie is a masterpiece in my judgment. Not that I'm some film critic, but I just think it's magnificent. And I've seen it now probably 6 or 7 times. And every time I see it, it takes my breath away about the ingenuity of these artists pulling this thing off.
So we should see Casablanca before we see I Feel Pretty. Is that what you're saying?
There you go. That's right. Or after, whatever. I'm not sure which. But the bottom line is that the love triangle is the great, European hero Victor Laszlo is leading the resistance against the Nazis. Rick is the bar owner that is sitting on the sidelines, and Ilsa is the great beauty who is married to Laszlo. But it's a secret marriage in the underground to keep her safer, and she believes that he is dead, and she takes up a romance with Rick. And so, as this plays out, it's one of the greatest performances of a love triangle that you will ever see. And as it plays out, we see that down in her gut, Rick, played by Bogart, is sexier than Laszlo. Now, Laszlo is taller, he's handsome, he's charismatic as hell, he's a wonderful human being, but he's not as sexy as Rick. And, of course, we could chalk this up to animal instincts, pheromones, and everything else under the sun. But I believe that, through brilliant artistry, the people that wrote, directed, and acted this came up with a big reason why this is true, even though they don't put their finger on it, and they may not have, they likely did not consciously identify it, but they feel it and they play it. And that is, you get from Rick's signaling to Ilsa is that she's the most important thing in the world, and that the whole damn world could burn down around them, and he would save her, and everybody else could go to hell. Whereas Laszlo is clearly showing the world that he is out to spend his energies in saving the world. And he, although he loves Ilsa, that is second. Okay? So this is, the person that wrote this question is, if we look deeply into this conflict, we are seeing Victor Laszlo. Now, Victor Laszlo is an extraordinarily admirable character. We actually admire the sacrifices that he's doing. But at home, Ilsa is like, damn, I'm not that happy. Okay? I can't object to what a magnificent man this is, but it's not directed at me. It's not in my best interest. He is grandstanding, he's magnificent to both the men and the women of the world. And that doesn't do me a lot of good. Okay? Whereas Rick is all about Ilsa. And so that's the nature of the conflict that is captured beautifully in Casablanca, and it's the conflict about how it's playing out in the question. It plays out in all relationships all the time, and so we are unconsciously taking the temperature of the esteem dynamic. How much do they value me? How high am I in their hierarchy? And therefore, what signals are they sending in terms of the cost-benefit analysis that they are running with respect to what my needs and interests are versus what needs and interests for other third parties that they could serve in order to win esteem with them? So that is the long analysis of what's taking place, And we are right to smell a rat and be upset and have our feelings hurt when we start seeing energies directed at parties and not us, and we're feeling, you know, in an insecure deficiency situation. That is not an accident, and it is not likely to be a distortion. All right.
Fantastic. Would you think that there is a measurable correlation between personality characteristics that tend to do this more than others? For example, if somebody is more disagreeable, would they want to be displaying more often than someone who's agreeable?
Probably. Yeah, because it's interesting. That's good. It's good thinking. I would assume that would be true, because the disagreeable person would be willing to put up with the conflict of interest close to home, that they would be getting signals from their partner that would be saying, "Hey, how come you're directing resources outside?" And their attitude would be, "I'm going to do it. Okay, I'm going to do it anyway." And so there's it isn't that I haven't seen very agreeable people do that. I have. But I think statistically we're going to find that would be likely to be the case.
Fantastic.
All right.
All right. Is there a Doug download on altruism further than this discussion?
Well, certainly there is. I mean, we could go further, but let's not wind it out tonight. This call goes to monkeys scratching each other's back and picking worms out of each other's hide, and how this essentially evolved out of delayed reciprocal agreements in animal grooming behavior. And so we'll I don't feel like winding that out tonight. We'll wind it out another night.
All right, fantastic. Well, we actually have two callers online now, so
okay.
Why don't we get to first one, then the second one, and then we can wind down with questions if we need. So we're going to welcome Kate from Seattle. Kate, welcome to the show.
Very good.
Thank you.
Hi there, Kate.
Hi, Dr. Lyle. I'll just tell you the situation, and then maybe you can address whatever points you think you can.
Okay.
I have two sons. One is 17 and one is 14. My 17-year-old was a tough kid to raise. He was oppositional, defiant, and hyperactive. And I stayed home for 13 years. I gave up my career to raise him. And then my younger son had different health issues. Mm-hmm. And my 17-year-old, in the last 4 years, he's totally turned around and is just a dream. He's just a magnificent young man, and I feel just super impressed with him. My 14-year-old, he had trouble hearing until he was like 4 and a half, and he has different allergies and constitutional growth delays, so he'll reach puberty in his maximum height a little later than other kids. Mm-hmm. And he has we're moving out of a private school and going into public, mostly because we're out of money. But who knows, maybe it'll be better for him anyway because they do have special ed. And so one of the things we're trying to figure out is, should we have him repeat eighth grade, because that would give him help with the basics and help him, give him more time to mature. And some have said, yes, you know, whatever you can do to help him be ready for high school. But the stronger voice is saying, no, especially if he doesn't want to, which he doesn't want to. He definitely wants to go with the rest of his class into high school. Let the IEP do the work with the academics. And then if he needs to take an extra year to graduate, give him that extra year. And because that shadow of having been held back will make him feel stupid and be a cloud over his head, and he'll never change his mind. But, you know, he'll always feel bad about that. And so we're trying to sort that out. And and I'm trying to figure out what will really help him, because I've always tutored him in math, and then we have other tutors for different subjects. And then at the same time, I'm panicky because we didn't contribute to our retirement the whole time that I was a stay-at-home mom, and I'm back in the workforce, but it's I really had to start at the bottom, and so I'm at a point where I could take a different job that is a little bit higher pressure, but it would be less stress on the financial side because I'd be making more money, and so I'm trying to just kind of figure out the best strategy going forward. And then I'm also emotionally, sometimes when there's parents that are around and they've got super high achiever kids, I feel guilty that I feel bad that my kid is struggling so much. And so I don't know, what are some of your thoughts?
Well, my first thought is that, so he's coming from a private school. He finished eighth grade in the private school?
Yeah.
Okay. And how is he now? He, and it sounds to me like he's headed for, given where his, what his issues have been, he's headed for a special ed kind of a situation?
Definitely in special ed, yeah.
Okay.
Where
so
they'll
he'll definitely
give him, like, easier classes. In
right.
Math,
so there's going to be
in language arts.
Yeah, there's going to be a bunch of accommodating. Okay, the
mm-hmm.
and so I guess another question that I want to make clear on. So I'm not sure how your financial issues and job stuff concerns factor into this at all. So explain
well,
that to me again because I'm not clear.
Yeah, partly because I feel like my focus needs to be on making money and getting my career on track. I feel like I'm 50 and it's getting harder and harder to compete with the younger generation. And if I don't put my full efforts into it, I won't be able to make up for all that time that I was, you know, wasn't putting away in savings and
right.
To stop investing so much time in tutoring him at night. You know, all my energy
right.
goes into that. And
right.
I feel like, well, is it going to help him? Is it really going to help him succeed in life? And
got it.
What's the best thing to do?
Got it. Okay, now I think I get the picture. Okay, so here are my thoughts about this. The my thoughts are that your child's success in life does not depend upon at what moment he hits a given milestone. Okay? So it makes no difference at all. So the point is, and the little official milestones, like when you graduated from high school, and you know, et cetera, these are meaningless. They don't have any impact at all. The only thing that matters is what is the value of his abilities at some point in the game. Okay? So that's all that counts. So my feeling is that he's in special ed, so he's clearly identified as having special needs, and therefore it doesn't really matter what on earth he does in school these next few years. It's not relevant. His essentially school is not teaching anybody anything of any significance. It's a placeholder for the maturation of the brain. That's actually what's taking place. So I, you know, Paul Simon's beautiful first line to Kodachrome is, when I look back on all the crap I learned in high school, it's a wonder I can think at all. You know what I mean? It's like it doesn't make any difference. He's not learning any skills or knowledge of any marketable significance. So I don't take seriously scholastic achievement. All scholastic achievement is a fitness indicator for people at the top to fight their way into fancier colleges, okay? Oops, did I lose you? Are you still with us?
No, I'm still there.
Okay,
mm-hmm.
Here. Okay. So my thinking is, he goes to special ed, and if he doesn't want to go to the eighth grade again, I wouldn't send him to the eighth grade again. We're not trying to put this kid in a position to compete better so that somehow he looks better relative to his peers. For what purpose? Okay.
Mm-hmm.
He's in special ed. He's going to struggle. They will accommodate and accommodate and accommodate and pass him through. And as long as he shows up and doesn't hit anybody and isn't a major behavioral problem, he'll wind up with a high school diploma, which is fine. And all is well. And so all that's really happening is we are watching and waiting and feeding him healthy food and watching this embryo continue to grow. That's what's taking place. Now, then when he's done with high school and he's essentially no longer a ward of the state for 6 or 7 hours a day, then it's the issue of, okay, well, now that we've got this 18-year-old with XYZ capabilities and strengths and weaknesses, what do we do from here? Okay? And if it turns out he's still growing and increasing his capabilities, and let's suppose that he winds up to have some level of scholastic capability that would make him potential to pursue higher education, then we can. And maybe he's not ready because maybe he needs to go back and he's gaining English and math skills, and maybe he spends, you know, a year or two continuing to get older, gathering a few more of those skills on the side, and that 2 years later he's able to go to college. Okay? Maybe so, maybe not. If not, then it didn't make any difference anyway when he graduated from high school or under what circumstances. So the thinking and planning and assisting and helping is not really necessary now. It's going to be necessary when he's 18 as we try to figure out how he's going to find his niche in the world given his strengths and weaknesses. That we'll worry about that later because we don't even know what those are going to be. Okay? So, yeah, my thinking is, if the young man does not want to repeat the eighth grade, it's not like if we repeat the eighth grade, then he's going to sail through brilliantly, and then he's going to be fine for 9th, 10th, 11th, 12th. This is going to be a struggle the whole way through, and I wouldn't invest a great deal of time and energy in it. You do a modest amount. We assist him to some degree. He does the best he can, and we move on. That's how I would do it. And otherwise, don't worry about it. This is I would not be worrying about his failures in school, nor would I be cheering his successes. I would have a very matter-of-fact attitude that what I'm really doing is watching a tree grow. Okay, and that's all that's happening here. And we will aid and abet it by watering it and taking care of it and keeping the cats from scratching it, and just let him grow up. And we'll see what we've got when he's a young man, and we will help him as he needs help at that point. Okay?
Okay.
All right.
That sounds
very
great.
Good, Kate. Very good call, and thank you for calling. It's a good question.
Kate, thank you very much for the phone call. Really appreciate it. All right, our next caller. Rob, Welcome to the show again.
Hey, Nate, remember that time you said you went on the date with the girl and you were disappointed how she looked, so you...
Oh, no.
You walked away. I have a solution to this. All you got to do is Skype or FaceTime with them before you meet up in person.
Yeah, but they won't want to come on a date with me.
I just want to know for the audience. I have nothing to do with this. Yeah. All right. Go ahead, Rob.
The problem is they won't want to come on the date with me if I show them my face. So it's kind of a catch 22. Yeah.
All right.
Hey, Dr. Lyle.
Yes, sir.
Are you beating your genes by not adopting identity politics? And what I mean by that is you could assume back in the village mindset, everyone looked the same and all that. But I'm curious, Dr. Lyle, if in your upcoming book, if you feel the need to include anything that relates to this, because what I mean is since the modern left wants to make everything about identity politics, do you feel the need to include anything from a biological male perspective in your upcoming book versus a female perspective? And I don't think males are superior to females or the other way around. To me, it's a stupid question. It's like asking if protons are superior to electrons. We all need each other, and no one's superior to anyone, and I treat people as individuals. But I'm just curious if someone as brilliant as you sees the need, because of everything has become so political now and filled with identity politics, and you're mostly talking to a Western audience in the U.S., U.K., Australia, et cetera, presumably because you're live in the West and it's going to be written in English. Do you feel the need to include any of that in your upcoming book?
Well, you got a lot of things that you said there, and I can't even, I don't even want to get started at asking you to repeat it so I get it clear. I'm just going to give you some impressions about my thinking about politics in general. I'm basically amused by politics, and I'm not really very interested. And I don't consider it very important. And by that, I mean I don't consider it very important to my personal existence. It may be incredibly important if you're in a given company somewhere and your company is about to get a bunch of graft because your guy is going to get elected. Okay, this could be an incredibly big deal for you, all right? But for me, it's not, since I don't have any friends in Washington. And essentially, the United States government, the way it's set up, is more or less got a set of rules that's more or less very stable over time. And essentially, to quote Jim Rohn, the major future to my the major key to my better future is me. Okay, so government cuts the taxes a little bit or raises the taxes a little bit. None of this really has any substantial influence on me. So I mean, even though I can get caught in the cheering and the angst, just like everybody else does if my team wins or loses, but the truth is that I maintain a very detached and quite disinterested perspective on the whole show. So I can criticize the left and the right with equal fervor from my theoretical perspective about how I think human beings ought to set up their existence. But I forget who said it. There was a famous quote that says, two cheers for democracy. And that means that, you know, three cheers would be if it was really good. Two cheers is like, well, it's kind of what we have and it's halfway decent. And it's kind of like a meal that you paid $8 for at kind of a cheap restaurant, and you walk away, it's like, well, it wasn't too bad, but it wasn't too good, but it wasn't too bad. And that's kind of how I always view the state of American politics. Okay? All right.
Rob, thank you very much for the
good
call
enough.
And
good
the question.
Thank you, sir.
This actually goes perfectly into our another question that we've had in the queue for a little bit with regards to politics.
Oh,
so you want to take that one, or do you want to save that one for a different day? Yeah.
Why not?
Okay. All right. So this is from a listener who says, Dr. Lyle, what's wrong with socialism? I thought we were trying to beat our genes. And it seems to me that unregulated capitalism is abject surrender to our selfish buggers. I'm all for democratic socialism, says the listener, and would love to hear Dr. Lyle's rant against it.
Oh, this is a sweetheart. Okay. So democratic socialism, I think, is the new phrase out of the Bernie Sanders era. And I have no doubt that if I met Bernie Sanders, I'd want to kiss him on his forehead. I actually believe he's a very sweet guy. I could be wrong. He could be some freaking killer when you get close to him, and maybe he is, but I don't think so. I think the guy is what I see there, and I think he's sweet. And most people that talk like this listener and what they're saying here are sweet. This is the dynamic tension between socialism and capitalism is the ancient Stone Age tension between share and not share. When you're viewing the world from a perspective of where it looks like there's extraordinary differences in how people are living, then it will hit the little circuits inside of many people, and they will say, this is an extremely uneven landscape, we should share more. So I understand this. Now, and that's why, even though my philosophical center is libertarianism, libertarians themselves will disagree quite a bit about what a society ought to look like. And I'm a laid-back libertarian who would believe in some degree of social welfare. I think it makes sense. My purist friends will squeal, but I think I could defend it to anybody that would want to argue with me about this. Now, however, that doesn't mean that I'm not a libertarian. It doesn't mean that I know for a fact that socialism is ridiculous, a totally absurd way for people to run a society. The reasons are deep and varied, but the most important thing to understand is that socialism cannot accomplish the fundamental problem of economics. So the fundamental problem of economics is how to transform atoms with human energy into products and services that serve human interests. That is the economic problem. And so how to go about that, like what should the energy do? Should it be turning things into turning all the material of that is now built Los Angeles and turn it into a bunch of compacted bricks that build pyramids out in the Mojave Desert? Is that what it should be? Socialism has no answer for this. None. There's no way for them to know whether or not that is the correct thing for human beings to be doing to optimally serve human interests. So it turns out that the only way to accomplish how to organize human action in order to optimize the land, labor, and resources of humanity to serve human interests optimally is to use a market economy. It's the only way to do it. And within that market economy, you cannot have a tax structure that disincentivizes efficiency in human action, because you will then disincentivize innovation and excellence. And so this, the concept of what is necessary is freely fluctuating prices and freely fluctuating profit margins in the solution of the economic problem was, I believe, first identified by Vilfredo Pareto in the early 20th century. And to students of economics, they are all aware of Vilfredo Pareto, and they understand his vision and how he arrived at this. A little bit later on, maybe a decade later after Pareto worked from his logic, a different economist working from a different angle arrived at essentially the same solution, and that was the Austrian Ludwig von Mises. So in the decades to follow, there would be, of course, many battles about this and et cetera, but in the end, there's no question that this is how it works, that you must have freely fluctuating prices. This is the only way for you to actually optimize resource allocation across industries, across, you know, essentially vendors. In other words, you have to use the profit motive in order for people to find out that when there's a cost of doing something, if it turns out that there is a tremendous amount of people willing to trade a high amount of resources in order to get that thing, and it's a lot less costly than what it is that they're giving you, then the profit is very, very high. And what happens then is that this is a signal to humanity that the resources have been previously misallocated and that not enough resources have been allocated to this widget that is obviously highly profitable. Okay? So now the question is, how many resources should we allocate to that widget? And the answer is enough resources to the where the profit margins now reach the same type of profit margins that are being seen across all other industries. So under socialism, you would have never had a computer industry, okay? Not unless somebody said, well, I think those computers, that's pretty fancy what von Neumann and these guys have figured out, so let's go ahead and now make some computers. Well, how many? Okay? How many relative to how many high heel red shoes that we're going to have of size 5? There's no way that socialism can possibly figure out how many high-heeled red shoes you should have versus how many rolling luggages that you should have of a given size versus how many false eyelashes you should manufacture versus how many tires you should manufacture for your cars. This is impossible, okay? And so this is precisely what von Mises and Friedman and Hayek were screaming for 50 years, that when you use any kind of disturbance, you know, price controls, wage controls, or God forbid, the ultimate of absurdity is a socialistic top-down government who decides what's going to be manufactured. You do that and you condemn human beings to massive misallocation of resources in such a way that you guarantee that you will have a huge degree of poverty and deprivation relative to what you would have had. So socialism, although it tickles the share circuits inside of many nice people, and it tickles the authoritarian vicious circuits inside of a bunch of socialistic despots like Adolf Hitler. It's always amusing that people think that fascism and socialism are different. They're the same thing. Okay, this is collective collectivism, top-down government dictating the allocation of resources. Depends on how many guns you use. That's a matter of fashion. But the point is that you are forcing the allocation of resources away from what people really want to do. A libertarian view says the following, and it's the only really morally defensive position, and that is that human beings should be free to do what it is that they want to do so long as they don't forcibly interfere with the rights of others to do the same. That means that we can take advantage of trade and therefore profit to signal to us what do other people really want. That is the beauty of free market economics. That has been taking place for tens of thousands of years, but our understanding of why it is the right way to do it was not actually achieved until the 20th century. So we now understand this. So the person who asked the question, I would actually send you to some books so that you can understand this more fully. There's three books that I would highly recommend for anyone who's trying to actually find their way and understand what a reasonable position is in terms of humans and their government. For a more global perspective, I would recommend Free to Choose by Milton Friedman. He covers many different issues trying to explain these principles. From the standpoint of a sort of meticulous understanding of how economics works and how the profit motive leads to and a free market process leads to the optimum allocation of resources, and it doesn't mean that it reaches an equilibrium ever. In other words, this will explain that it is always a dynamic. As soon as somebody has had a chunk of chocolate cake, now the demand for chocolate cake just got reduced by some infinitesimal amount, and only the free market can figure out what on earth we're going to do about this allocation of resource problem. The best presentation that I ever saw that is extremely readable, easy to read, and easy to understand is in a book that's long since out of print by Harry Brown, and the book is called You Can Profit from a Monetary Crisis. And the first 100 pages of that book are the finest presentation of free market logic that I've ever seen. Another book that I would recommend that will pound over the skull, it's very difficult for people to understand this. They look at the government and they see all the wonderful things that the government does, whether it's a socialistic government or a mixed economy government like the United States. They point to the Tennessee Valley Authority and they say, look at what the government did. That is a mistake. And the mistake is that the government cannot create anything. All the government can do is allocate resources. And whenever the government allocates resources, they are allocating them away from where the free market would have put them, which means they are creating they are reducing the standard of living of everybody who is actually involved in that process, unless they're a person that doesn't pay their fair share of taxes, at which point they are, essentially benefiting. They're a free rider. Now, the best book that I've ever seen on this, it was called Economics in One Lesson, from Henry Hazlitt. And so I'm sure it can be found in Amazon. Again, very readable, very easy to see. Hazlitt is going after a single principle over and over again, showing you that all the government does is transfer resources from one location to another location. And when you see the government has achieved something, you have not seen what the free market would have achieved with those resources. And so you mistakenly say, look what the government accomplished, rather than what did the free market not accomplish because of what the government took from it? Okay, so that is Economics in One Lesson. So this is a long explanation with a lot of detail about why I think the way I think. But the truth of the matter is, for this person asking this question, who's asking a very heartfelt question and really believes in their position, and I understand this, that what I'm telling you is that you don't understand economics. And so your position that you have is coming from a sort of a Stone Age moral feeling about fairness that I appreciate, but you are actually not understanding the fundamentals of how economics works and how economic problems are solved and what is the source of human poverty and misery, and what is the source of human prosperity. And only by understanding free market principles of economics can you achieve that understanding. And once you do, there is no way anyone that has such understanding could possibly defend socialism. So I am sure Bernie Sanders has really no understanding of this. And a great many politicians, I don't believe, do. So anyway, that's the answer to that question. That's probably do we have another short question, Nate?
Let's see. We have one about internet trolls. What do you think?
Go ahead. Hit me up with it, and we'll call it a night.
Okay. Dear Dr. Lyle, why are people so mean on the internet or when it's anonymous? What do they get out of it? Most people would not come up to you in person and say rude comments, but they have no problem saying it on social media, like on Facebook or YouTube comments. How does that exactly foster their gene survival?
Really great question. And it's a it makes the internet sort of a dicey place for this sort of thing. The reason that, remember, let's go back and try to understand why anybody does anything. They do anything that they do because they're running a cost-benefit analysis. So they're criticizing other people is a strategic behavior designed by nature to lower the status of competitors or in other words, alter the status relationship between you and your competitors, either raising your own relative to them or lowering theirs relative to yours. So therefore, criticism is a ubiquitous characteristic of the species. So this people are constantly trying to figure out how to either blatantly or cleverly criticize their competitors. That's what it is that they would do. And so it would pay for them to do that. However, when you criticize your competitors, you also set yourself up for being identified as a costly social, vector. And so therefore, it could pay for them to kill you, for example. Or otherwise undermine your status. So whether they would eliminate you and your whole family, i.e. the ultimate gene cost to you, or they would merely criticize you back, one way or the other, it would be in their best interest to impose costs on you. So the ideal situation from our standpoint would be to how we could effectively and brutally criticize our competitors without having any retribution in return. So the internet provides that possibility, and that's why it is that you get what you get. They are running cost-benefit analysis on that equation, and if they consider that someone on the internet is someone that they could, that it would benefit them enough to go to some trouble to criticize them and get away with it and hopefully have that criticism be effective, then that's what they would do. And so no surprise at all. It's actually no mystery whatsoever. All right?
Yeah, and so there's I've seen different comments that are critical, and some of them can get really mean, and where they're actually – it can seem like they're getting a lot of pleasure out of this. And
yeah.
So would this just lead us to believe that these are just sociopathic tendencies of people, highly disagreeable, and they just – they see this as someone's out competing them, and they're living at home at mama's basement, and they're just have to criticize you basically.
Could get really bad. It wouldn't have to be sociopathic. It could simply be just very, very disagreeable, very feeling like the other person is unfairly getting a bunch of status and that they are not getting it. So, but as you say, as we get more unstable personalities, more disagreeable personalities, and less conscientious personalities, this would become increasingly dangerous. And so my brother-in-law was a very successful attorney. And in much of his career, I would listen to his cases. And at times I was disgusted with what the whole case was about. And I can remember that a psychiatrist was being sued by some nutcase over an agreement that he had with them to sell a piano. And this was some person who there was some transaction involved here. And the And I remember listening to this and hearing the trials and tribulations of everything that went on in this case. And I said to him, all that over an effing piano. Like, I was disgusted. This whole thing amounted to me as nothing other than a complete and total waste of time. And he looked at me and he said, no, it was about a career. He was being accused of using his great psychiatric powers to manipulate blah, blah, blah. And literally, the attack on him was after his career. And my brother-in-law brilliantly defended him. And so this is, you know, the problem is that there's people out there that are that have some loose wiring, screwy wiring, and can be very, very dangerous to us. And that's why, even though I don't follow my own advice often, it is a good strategy to be very judicious about being critical, you know, about anybody. And in fact, I have in my mind's eye a mafia chieftain speaking to his young nephew about how on earth you live in this business, which is, as he pulls a cigar out of his mouth, he says, never criticize nobody. And that's when you get into hot water with disagreeable people, that could be dangerous. That's usually a good strategy. Move very quickly to an area of ground where we're not engaged in an esteemed dynamic of mutual criticism. Get out of it as fast as you can.
Fantastic.
All right.
All right. That answers the internet trolls.
All right.
Dr.
Lath,
thank you so much. Yeah, excellent. We'll look forward to it. Oh, go ahead.
Yeah, my pleasure. Very good. We'll do it again next week.
Sounds good. We'll talk to everybody next week. Thanks for listening. If you like what you hear, subscribe, write us a review, or share this podcast with a friend. To send in a question or read more about the show, you can visit our website at www.beatyourgenes.org. Until next time, this is Nate G. and Dr. Lyle with Beat Your Genes, an evolutionary psychology podcast for finding happiness in the modern world.